The chair calls the Education Policy Committee to order for Tuesday, March 3rd, 2026. And the committee legislative assistant will note the roll. A quorum is present, correct? We have a quorum. So Representative Bierman, have you had a chance to review the minutes? And if so, would you approve, move to approve the minutes? Thank you. Representative Bierman moves approval of the minutes. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, nay. The ayes have it. And the minutes for Wednesday, February 25th, 2026 are approved. So we have some presentations today, members, and we're going to start with the Professional Educators Licensing Standards Board. That's quite the, we'll just call you PELSB for short. I love that acronym. We've asked PELSB to provide an update or overview in the following areas: educator licensing, active or anticipated rulemaking, and teacher preparation programs. After the presentation, we'll have time for member discussion. I'm hoping we can use this time to start thinking about where we are with licensing and preparation and where we should be going, so I invite active member participation. When we've concluded the presentation and discussion, we'll proceed to three bills on the agenda. My intent is to hear and discuss the bills in the following order. We'll start with the bill draft language of Representative Mueller. Second will be House File 3635 on the Interstate Compact. And third will be House File 3638 with policy items from PELSB. The intention will be to lay over House File 3635 and 3638 for future consideration and work. And I expect our committee members will have more discussions before moving anything forward. So we're going to focus today on this presentation and the discussion around clinical experience for teacher candidates. I've already advised Dr. Bailey that hearing and discussing the two PELSB bills will be dependent on time, but I think we can hopefully keep things moving here. And we're happy to add those bills to our agenda today, given our limited committee schedule. So with that, I'm going to invite the testifiers to state their names for the record and proceed.
All right. Thank you, Chair Bennett, Chair Jordan, members of the committee. Thank you for having us here today. My name is Dr. Elena Bailey, and I'm the Executive Director of PELSB. I'll let you introduce yourself.
Good afternoon. My name is Lucy Payne. I am the chair of PELSB and represent teacher preparation programs. I work at the University of St. Thomas. So we're going to start our presentation grounding us in our mission and vision. And as you can see on the slides, our mission is centered on students. We're a teacher licensing board, and so we are very focused on those students. And in order for our mission to come to be, we have the vision around ensuring equitable education practices through high licensure standards. That high licensure standards piece is very important to us and will come up multiple times in our presentation today as we think about the future of licensing and our work. So also I want to highlight in our vision that we are focused on quality education programs and community partner engagement, and we have specific meetings and times for that and include our community partners in our rulemaking process. On this slide, you will see the current makeup of our board. There are 13 members. We have one vacant seat right now, our public member, but we have a very diverse board in terms of experience, licensure area, and geography, which is really important to our work. We have very good conversations at the table and have learned to work well together by spending time together in retreats and planning sessions and then digging deeply into the hard work that we have in front of us.
All right, I'll speak to this one. So we always like to start with a snapshot of our board's work over the last fiscal year. So you can see the scope of work that our small but mighty agency manages to accomplish each year. And so we are a staff, when we're fully staffed, about 26 staff members serving 110,000 licensed teachers across the state of Minnesota. As you'll see, PELSB is responsible for the accreditation of 38 teacher preparation providers across the state of Minnesota. About seven of those are alternative teacher preparation providers, and you'll hear a little bit more about that process later. Those programs oversee around 630 licensure programs across the state, and by licensure programs, we mean area specific, so elementary, social studies, things like that. In addition to those pathways, last fiscal year, we licensed 174 teachers through licensure via portfolio, and amongst those were 22 heritage language educators, so we're very excited about that work. Out of those 110,000 licensed teachers, each year, we have about 36,000 new licenses, renewals, and permissions that are processed, so quite a bit of work on that end. In addition, our board meets regularly. We have monthly board meetings, monthly committee meetings, and then an annual retreat where a lot of policy and governance work is done. That translates over to rulemaking, and last fiscal year we had two active rulemaking projects. You'll hear a little bit about those later. Another key aspect of our work is ethics investigations, and so last fiscal year we opened 231 cases, took 103 actions, and then in addition to those, had to look through about 560 files that had what we call flags for ethics concerns to make sure that we are licensing people who are appropriate to be in our classrooms. And then finally, we continue to work with about 535 districts and charter schools across the state of Minnesota to ensure they have the appropriate license or permission to be working and serving our students.
So currently, we have a couple key initiatives that we're working on, and one is streamlining teacher licensure. Our licensure system was built long ago for schools that are based on a factory model of education. You've heard about this before in many committee hearings over the years. I've been here listening to some of those things. But as we think about that, we know that our schools, because of the variety of sizes and geographies and things we have in our state, that having 80 different separate licenses is very problematic. And so we're looking for ways to streamline this licensure while maintaining, according to our mission and vision, high standards. We need the best quality teachers with the right depth of content knowledge in our classrooms, so we're working on streamlining that licensure to meet the future needs of our students. Three of the areas that we're working on right now specifically tied to this are around special education, science, and arts licensure. We have just directed our rulemaking committees in special education and the arts to narrow some licenses so we have fewer of them that maintain that high standards, that high quality of educator in order to support our students in our classrooms and our districts in filling those positions. The other thing we're highly concentrated right now is literacy. We are very much aware of and paying attention to what's happening in our K-12 schools because we work hand in hand with MTE. We have been working on READ Act aligned work. And so as we look at the reading audit process, this is a deep dive we did into what initial teacher preparation looks like in the area of reading. We reviewed every syllabi at every provider that we have to make sure the right content was being taught at the right depth of knowledge and the application in classrooms. There's more on the reading work, the audit specifically, in later slides. We did have a report to you earlier on in January 2025 on that audit. We have another report coming to you in August that'll finish up on that audit. And we have another piece coming after that, a continuous improvement rubric to help ensure that our programs continue to do what's best for students and continue to improve beyond what we'd even hoped they would do. We are also creating some guidance because our districts are very concerned about the professional development that's been done through the READ Act and then what initial teacher preparation is doing. So the literacy audit is telling us where each provider is, and when they meet the high quality standards that we have in place for reading, there will be a web page tied to us that districts can look at to say, yes, this candidate graduated from this program. They have met the same standards, quality assurances as the READ Act PD, and they won't need to do that again. So we're trying to avoid that expense and duplication of learning for our teachers. And the last one we have up there is this collaboration with teachers and teacher preparation on this literacy rubric, which I talked about a little bit earlier. And the great thing about that project is it is a cross collaboration. We do have district level literacy folks with us on that, assuring that the work we're doing in teacher prep is aligned to what's happening in our K-12 schools. Okay, on this slide, you see all of the rulemaking that is in process or scheduled, and you can see there's quite a bit up there. In 25-26, we are wrapping up the process around the school counselor programs, moving those from a Pelsby-approved process to a national accreditor process, our ECE, early childhood education, and educators speak in acronyms, I'm trying not to do that, but early childhood education, again, we're aligning to national standards in that area. Ethnic studies is tied to statutory requirements and having a license for those classes. Computer science licensure is in process and wrapping up, and then some legislative policy as well. As we look forward to 26-27, you see licensure areas listed that will be addressed in rulemaking, but that rulemaking has already started. We have already asked educators to come together around the sciences, around heritage language, and we even have licensure groups already working in the following year in the special ed space and are talking now about bringing together a reading licensure group to do some initial work before we actually open the formal rulemaking process. Rulemaking is a very long process because of that community engagement piece, which is very important. We have to involve our K-12 classroom teachers in that work and our teacher preparation providers because it's their work that comes together to ensure that we have the best licensure system possible.
And we're happy to continue unless the chair would like us to pause for questions in between. Okay, thank you. All right, so I'll share some updates on licensure, and these actually come from our recent supply and demand report. As a reminder, because of a legislative change, we had a supply and demand report due this past November, and we'll actually have another one coming this November. One of the things we've learned is that this is an opportunity for some great change to really rethink the way we consider supply and demand in our state and how we're presenting the data. So happy to take feedback and questions and suggestions or to talk offline. I'll share a few findings here today with a few graphs and a lot of data, and happy to answer some questions on that. But here are some highlights. We continue to have about 36% of our licensed teachers who hold a Tier 3 and Tier 4 license are not in a public school classroom. That does not mean they're not working in education. We have a good number of those, although we don't have that exact number. We know a good portion are working in our private schools. We also know that many are board members, employees at MDE and Pelsby, or state legislators. So many educators are still licensed, but not necessarily in a classroom. Still, nearly 90% of those who are working in our classrooms hold that full professional license. We have some information around shortages, and one of the ways we frame that is by looking at Tier 1 licenses, Tier 2 licenses, and permissions, not because Tier 1 and Tier 2 aren't valid teaching licenses, but because they are limited in term and are tied to a specific district and assignment, so they're not a permanent solution to filling that need in a school. So that's one of the ways we get information from districts to say, okay, you still need a permanent teacher with a full professional license to fill these areas. Unsurprisingly, many of those are in special education, world languages, and career and technical education. So there continues to be a need to find ways to get teachers professionally licensed in those areas. We did see a pretty even distribution of need across all of the regions in our state. So the shortage needs are fairly similar across, whether you're in Greater Minnesota or in the metro. We saw a slight increase in the number of teachers of color and American Indian teachers. I remember starting 7 years ago at Pelsby, and we were around 5.5%, and I think now we're at 7.4, you'll see. But there's a significant gap because our students of color and American Indian students continue to grow, so we're nowhere near closing that gap. Unfortunately, we continue to see that nearly a third of our teachers who are new to the profession leave within the first 5 years, and so that we continue to need to make some changes around retention, although I will have some positive data on retention as well in the presentation. And then finally, we did revamp our district survey this year to get some more detailed information on how school districts are perceiving the shortage. And we did see that there wasn't a significant change in what they perceived from the last school year to the school year they were surveyed in. This is a lot of information, but it's just a quick snapshot that gives you a picture of our teacher workforce broken down by race and ethnicity. And so that first or that second column, you'll see the number of teachers who hold a license in broken down by race and ethnicity. And then you'll see the tier count shows you in each group how many individuals hold that tier license. The percentage really gives you a sense of what proportion of each group holds a particular tiered license. So for example, in that first or second row, you'll see about 2.7% of our American Indian or Alaska Native teachers hold a Tier 1, and about 25% of them hold a Tier 3, and nearly 70% of them hold a Tier 4 license. This is useful for showing us a couple of things. One is that the vast majority of our teachers, again, hold that full professional license, both number and proportion-wise. However, you'll see a higher use rate amongst our Black and African American teachers of a Tier 1 and Tier 2 license. So this gives you a couple of different pieces of information. This is how we are currently looking at some of the demand in the state, is again, both the number and the percentage use of Tier 1, Tier 2 licenses and permissions. And again, that's only because those are licenses and permissions that can't permanently fill a need in a school. So on the left-hand side, you'll see this is the greatest number. Unsurprisingly, the vast majority of these are in special education, so academic and behavioral strategists, autism spectrum disorders, et cetera. Although you will see some elementary, comm arts, things like that. On the right-hand side, we do percentage. And while these are smaller numbers, it helps that you'll see exclusively in world languages and in career and technical education, there are areas that are almost entirely filled by having a Tier 1, a Tier 2, or permission. So there's still a great need for professional paths for those areas. I am very happy to say, though, that the world language need is currently being solved. As you remember from that first slide, we had 22 educators who are licensed in that heritage language that, thanks to you all, passed a couple of years ago. And so some of this will disappear or change in the data over the next couple of years. This slide shows, again, that Tier 1, Tier 2 OFP use across all of the economic development regions in the state of Minnesota. And there is some variation, but as you'll see, it's not drastic, so there's a pretty similar need across the state. I will point out, if you're wondering about that last column, I get that from our STAR report, where we ask districts what license or permission a teacher has to fill an assignment. There are some, unfortunately, instances where a district has someone who doesn't have a permission or a license to fill an assignment at all, or not the correct one, and so they are, quote unquote, out of compliance. So that's another way we can think of need in that category. So I'll highlight what's on the row of this graph because it is interesting. We were able to have some really meaningful data from our districts through the survey this year. We asked them about their perceptions of the teacher shortage between the 23-24 and 24-25 school years. That green bar, as you can see, overwhelmingly, they say it stayed the same. But what's interesting is that we're able to ask more questions about types of shortage. So we've had a lot of conversations with legislators and our community members about vacancies, for example, and we're unable to collect that through STAR because, as you can imagine, IT changes are not free, and so we're not able to do it that way, but we're able to get some survey data on it. So you'll see them reporting on difficulties around vacancies, availability of teachers, length of time to fill a position, positions remaining open, or courses having to be canceled. Overwhelmingly, though, there's a sense that there hasn't been a significant change, that things have stayed the same. This is the table that shows the comparison of our teachers of color and American Indian teachers to our students of color and American Indian students. As you can see, statewide, we have increased to 7.4%. However, our students are nearly 40%, so that gap persists. There has been, I will say, great success with some of the programs that you all have funded, but it is not enough to keep up with the growing need. This is a bit of a wonky table, so I'll take a minute to explain it. This is that unfortunate statistic that we end up discussing each time we have a supply and demand report, which is that we have a strong, a big issue with attrition, unfortunately, in our state. It's not unique to Minnesota. It tends to be common across the country, but this is the data that kind of reflects that. And so you'll see the cohort year, or when a set of teachers entered the teaching profession, and the number of them in that second column, and then tracked throughout the years how many of them came back. That percentage difference is overall.
Can I pause you 1 second? Excuse me. I'm sorry for the interruption. Members, so the pages or the accidentally thought these were the same presentation, so they left one out of ours. So we're getting you the one you're missing. Okay, so there, we could see there's a little confusion, so I wanted to stop so we can concentrate, but go ahead and continue. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Bennett. I wondered, I was hoping it wasn't me walking through the tables. and happy to answer questions again after. So you'll notice the teachers who came in that 2021 year, we have the five-year data on them, and that's where about 29% of them did not return in their 24-25 school year. A couple of quick things I'll point out is that most recently the data we have on teachers who entered 23-24, and then came back in 24-25. It's a little bit of a higher drop than we typically see. Normally it's around 13-14%. We saw 16.5, which is a little bit more and obviously a little concerning. The other thing I'll point out is that jump you see in that third row is around COVID time, and so we did see a bit of a jump there of teachers that didn't return for understandable reasons. Here's the positive slide on retention. So we as a state have really been thinking differently about retention and trying to get a clearer definition. So we're looking at a five-year retention rate and looking at it both the state level, the district and region level, and then the school level. State level, so we can, of course, hopefully provide good data to you all as you're thinking about policies and funding and things like that. But at the school and the district level, because a lot of our community members want to make sure the teachers that serve them are still staying in their schools and in their communities to serve the students that they are part of community with. So of the 73,000 educators that were reported working this past school year, 77% were working 5 years ago. So that's a 77% statewide retention rate. That's great news. About 75% of those were in the same assignment, so that means if they were a special ed teacher 5 years ago, they're still a special ed teacher, which is great. As we move down, you'll see some changes where about 63% are retained in the same district and region, and about 55% are retained in the same school. And again, that's important when you want to know that, you know, a kid who had, you know, Mrs. Johnson in third grade can have their little siblings still have Mrs. Johnson when they get there 5 years later. So we're looking forward to thinking about this data in different ways and how we can hopefully increase our retention rates over the next few years. I think that leads me to end with some of the next steps we've been thinking through. One of them is how we can be more strategic with some of the innovative pathways you all are funding. So for example, teacher apprenticeships are very popular right now for good reason. They combine some of the best practices we know of paid experience, long clinical experience. However, one of the things we've been talking with the registered teacher apprenticeship specialist at MDE is how we can bring together providers to be more strategic about where these programs are offered and which licensure areas so that we're meeting the demand that is actually there. The other item that Dr. Payne already spoke to is considering changes to licensure so that we're meeting the future needs of students, because what students will need 5 to 10 years from now in their classrooms is going to be very different from what they need right now. And I'm sure everyone in this room understands that it will take the government, by that I mean me, and the good folks at Pulse, be at least that long to implement whatever you pass. So we're going to need to start working on that now. And then finally, the biggest concern is how we can retain our high-quality educators. As Dr. Payne emphasized, our mission and vision are really about having high-quality educators in front of our students, but that only goes so far if they aren't staying in the classroom. And that is the end of my piece, and then I think we have teacher prep up next.
Thank you, and if you, when you're ready, if you can just state your name for the record and then go ahead and begin. And then members, we'll just have questions for all three when they're finished presenting.
Good afternoon, Chair and members. My name is Erin Doan, and I'm the Director of Educator Preparation and Pathways at Palsby, which has a lot of alliteration in it. So keep saying that quickly. It'll keep us all on our toes. Some of these things you've heard briefly about already, but we'll just touch on a few highlights as there will be some conversation around teacher preparation today. For teacher preparation providers in the state of Minnesota, there are 38 currently. You heard 7 of those are alternative providers. That means that not all of them are coming from higher education directly, but can come from school districts or charter schools or nonprofits as well. Outside of that, it's important to know that each of those providers goes through a 6-year cycle of approval in order to continue providing teacher preparation in our state. So submitting a self-study, going through that with a number of peer reviewers, and then coming around 6 years later to be able to go through a site visit and answer questions for, again, that team of peer reviewers for continuous improvement. Outside of the providers themselves, we are in the neighborhood of 650-ish programs in the state. So those are individual licensure programs that are being offered by those providers. So social studies or math or special education. Each of those programs goes through a 3-year cycle of approval with Palsby important to think about as we talk about making changes to each of those programs or to the licensure standards. That means that as we are making those changes, we're going to have an implementation timeline where we see those things rolling through over a number of years, three in this case. Both the standards of effective practice, or the pedagogy standards, and each of the content areas fall into that work of program approval. So in order for each of our providers to put a program forward, they're answering to the standards of effective practice plus content area standards, which you see here, the example of math that's in front of you. Another just general update based on the work that Dr. Bailey and Dr. Payne have shared with you already today. A little bit of an update on our reading audit with teacher preparation providers. We went through a multi-step process with them, a high-level audit to see how providers were meeting those reading standards, and then a little bit of a deeper level dive into each of the programs to be able to ensure that programs were meeting the expectations of the READ Act. At this point, we have about 89% of the programs that have already met those expectations and are moving forward. And expect all programs to be through that approval process by June 30th of this year. And then finally, just a high-level recap of some of our future work that is in process right now. Again, working on residency and apprenticeship, or ways for teachers to be learning while they are in classrooms for what might not look like a traditional 12-week student teaching. That becomes a bigger and bigger priority for us as we look at the models of what students and teachers need in the next 10 years, as well evaluating our data collection system so that we have good data and research behind the questions that you all are asking and the PELSB board members are asking about how do we know what's best and which direction should we be going with particular resources or any practices that we're wanting to see aligned in our state. And then finally, more important than ever, is the continued collaboration between agencies to make sure that we are implementing work in tandem. So with the Department of Education's Educator Workforce Center, lots of partnership taking place, as well with the Office of Higher Education, with the Department of Labor and Industry, and now with the Department of Children, Youth, and Families. So continued work in that area and continued collaboration to make sure that we're headed into a place where teachers and students are getting what they're needing to meet where we see them in 10 years. That's all I have for now.
Thank you. Is that the end of the presentations? I want to make sure. And thank you for being so diligent on getting us both these. And, you know, this is like I used to have with my first graders. Find the difference in these pictures. There's a one-word difference, so no problem for the pages. It's hard to discriminate sometimes between those. I was never good at those when I was younger either. So members, we're going to just have some discussion or questions here, and I'm going to take the prerogative actually as chair and ask the first question, I think maybe for you, Dr. Bailey, but whoever. I know it is concerning that a third, almost a third of teachers who start out teaching end up leaving by 5 years later. So my question is, are we collecting data on why they're leaving, and is that available?
Chair Bennett, members, it's a great question. So a few years ago, we did a survey to get some of this information, the MinSpire survey, and it's on our website for members of the public who are interested. And we found out it's largely down to things like school climate, community relationships. Of course, compensation plays a role. That tends to match what we know from national research, and so we haven't done much beyond that to continue the survey. And so one of the things we're looking forward to is working with BOSA, the Board of School Administrators, to think through how we can kind of collaborate on some of those efforts on school climate.
Thank you. That would be good to know so we can kind of identify what we need to work on more. So thank you. Members, do we have, okay, we have Representative Keeler. Oh, she stepped out.
She's interested in asking her
questions. Okay. So Representative Gottfried, and then we'll go back to Keeler, Representative Keeler.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, testifiers. I actually had a question about some of the statistics on slide 17, related to educator retention. I'm curious specifically with that first bullet point all entails. You know, it seems to me a 77% retention rate or folks of the 73,000 educators that were reported in as working this past school year, you know, 77% reported with an assignment from the 2020 to 2021 school year. Is that number inclusive of folks who were originally part of that cohort but not afterwards? So is this also capturing folks from 2020, like 2023 as well? Does this include retirements? I'm just trying to figure out exactly what this number represents. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Gottfried. And Representative, did you have any? Go ahead. Who's?
Yeah, sorry, Chair, about that. Representatives, great question.
Dr. Bates.
So there's a slight, you're good catch on these are slightly different types of data. And one is that this is of all of our educators that are working in our classrooms, how many were reported with an assignment the previous or 5 years ago. So that includes not just the full Tier 3 and Tier 4 or newly licensed teachers. This includes all of them. So it's a slightly different group. And then we do have to, again, small but mighty team, a one data specialist, do this by pulling the folks who have an assignment this year and then pulling 5 years ago and matching that up. And so it doesn't necessarily tell us what their different assignments were between those years, but that they were working in an assignment 5 years ago and are today. Does that answer your question?
Representative Gottfried.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. And thank you for that answer. I think so. I just, you know, I'm looking at this and I want to make sure that I understand it better, because if there's a 70, if it's claiming that there's like a 77% like retention rate from 5 years ago, well, that's like just at first blush still like a 23% attrition rate, which is not all, I mean, it's lower, but it's not all that lower than what was described in the first 5 years, and ostensibly still a problem. But you know, that could also include retirements, that could also include teachers that were not actually yet teaching in the 2020 to 2021 school year. And so I'm just curious, that's what I was trying to suss out, is like exactly what is all captured in this, so that we could get a true sense of what like a mid-career teacher professional would, you know, the retention rate of those folks would be. So that would be a statistic that I would be interested in finding out over time. So thank you, Madam Chair, appreciate it.
Okay, Representative Keeler, did you have a question?
Thank you. Sorry, Chair. I was trying to do too much at one time.
We're all trying to do that right now.
So I think my question, and maybe you answered it, but my question is more about the why people are leaving within 5 years. I think the thing, maybe, did you ask this question? Is it like LIFO? Is it the school's decision that they're not rehiring contracts? Or is it more a personal decision of the educator to move to a different career?
Dr. Bailey, and actually that was my very same question, but I'll let her answer it for you too. So thank you. That's okay.
Yes, Chair Bennett, Representative Keeler. Yes, so we did a survey a few years ago that showed a lot of it comes down to school climate, relationships with parents and community members, compensation. And so there's a number of factors, but the biggest one tends to be school climate and that relationship with community members and administrators. So we're hoping to work with the Board of School Administrators on ways to change that.
Representative Keeler, any follow-up?
No.
Okay. Like minds, right? Representative Green.
Thank you, Chair Bennett, and thank you for the presentation today. I have a question about cost for teachers when they're going through licensure, this whole process. Like, what are the costs for a teacher to be licensed? And does that fall out of their pocket? Does it the districts cover it? Just a better handle on the money piece would be great.
Dr. Bailey, is that yours?
Yeah. Chair Bennett, members, that's a great question. I am looking at our licensing and operations manager over there to make sure I'm correct, but I think I have in front of me it's about $90 for the initial application and $90.25. Thank you. This is why the experts are here. And that includes their licensing fee and their background check. So it's not a lot of money. We actually, as we look at, and if we have time to hear our agency bill later, you'll see some of the IT changes that we're working on and the continued need to have funding for that. And one of the things we've looked at are the fees, because we are drastically lower than every state around us. I think our good friends in North Dakota are around $200 to $250 per license, and we are less than half of that. But that does come out of the educator's pocket to pay for that licensing. We charge one fee for them to go, no matter how many licenses they're getting. So we are, I think, one of the most affordable states when it comes to that process.
Representative Green.
Thank you, Chair Bennett. Just one follow-up question.
Yes.
And that's a yearly, or just one time out of the gate?
Yeah. Dr. Bailey.
Yeah, Chair Bennett, Representative Green. So that is depending on when their renewal of their license. So if it's a tier one, it is yearly. If it's a tier two, it's every 2 years. But then for tier three and tier four, you're going to be 3 years to 5 years. So it's, and then they don't pay the background fee. They only have to do a background check once with us. So then it actually drops down to $57 for any additional renewals.
Representative Green.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Representative Hill.
Thank you, Chair Bennett. And thank you to our presenters. One of the matters, issues that I think has a lot of impact on retention of educators has to do with the lack of uniformity around mentoring programs. Not all districts even have a mentoring program for their new hires. And these mentoring programs show to be a great return on investment for retaining our young educators as they come into the field. Rep Mueller, Rep Bennett will surely acknowledge that teaching is a challenging profession. And when you find yourself isolated in that setting, it becomes all the more challenging. And so as districts get stressed financially, sometimes these are the first programs that that drop off the map. And like I said a moment ago, they oftentimes lead to the greatest retention of our new teachers in the profession. So really encourage to study the mentoring programs and just kind of how robust they are in different parts of the state.
Any comments, sir?
Yeah, Chair Bennett, Representative Pellet, great. I'm glad you brought that up. I should have mentioned that with the survey. But we did find that nationally, there's a lot of research on mentorship having a significant impact on retention. And so we're working with a few different schools on possibly case studies on best practices and how that might result in some policy proposals down the line for you all. So thank you.
Thank you. Representative Gordon.
Thank you, Chair Bennett. Dr. Bailey, you had mentioned the percentage of teachers of color and American Indian teachers doesn't proportionately reflect the diversity of the student population. And I'm just wondering, if there was an exodus of white teachers, then your proportionality would improve, but would that be a net benefit?
Dr. Bailey.
Chair Bennett, Representative Gordon. So that would, I don't think, benefit anyone. I think part of this conversation you've heard is we want to retain our high-quality educators regardless of their race or ethnicity or any other identifying factors. We do know that there is ample research that shows that teachers of diverse backgrounds benefit all of our students just because they're exposed to different ways of being and thinking in the world. So it is always wanting that to have the balance of exposure of our students to teachers of all backgrounds. But retaining our high-quality educators remains a top priority.
Representative Gordon, any follow-up?
Sure. Thank you, Chair, and thank you, Dr. Bailey. Yeah, I mean, I agree. I think any good teacher is going to be a benefit for our students. I just think that the statistic is kind of silly. We should be focused on hiring the best teachers, regardless of race or ethnic background. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Mueller.
Thank you, Chair Bennett, and thank you, guys. I have always had a good conversations with you, and all the comments that my colleagues have made up has been really amazing. I did have a couple of questions about teacher licensure as well and clock hours. And so having to renew my license this year, which is exciting, I did get to see some of the requirements that we had to do, and looking through your bill, seeing if we get through that or not, there is seemingly going to be some changes in clock hours for that. And one of the things that I have signed on to is House File 60 as well, that talks about specific clock hours for dyslexia training as well. And so just wanted to know, one of the changes that was in your bill was changing 1 hour to 5 hours of clock hours for mental health, and the rationale behind that, why it anyway, just some of those things. And if you are still hoping to see, I did not see it in your agency bill about having dyslexia training as one of your clock hour changes. So,
who would like that? Dr. Bailey?
Chair Bennett, Representative Mueller, I can start, and I don't know if Dr. Payne wants to speak to the reading portion. But for the mental, we're trying to shift it to mental health, which is a more holistic concept. That is already a current requirement. There isn't a set number of clock hours to the entire one, but it requires at least 1 hour of suicide prevention, and so that was shifted to, I believe, 5 hours on suicide prevention included in the broader training for mental health. So districts, local control do varying ways, but it wouldn't change necessarily that broader number of clock hours for that training, just up the training around suicide prevention given what we're hearing from schools and what our students' needs are right now. With regard to the dyslexia, I can say we have a significant work that's been done on the teacher prep side, and then it should be incorporated into that reading requirement that is there for teachers, but I don't know if you want to or anyone wants to add to that. Okay.
No? Okay. Representative Mueller.
Thank you, Chair Bennett. And yeah, I just know that as I know it didn't increase the total number of clock hours. I just know that, you know, for someone who went through the process just recently, like January, it was interesting to see, you know, I had more than enough clock hours in other places, but then to follow those specific requirements, which I don't disagree with, it would have been a very different experience for me to suddenly have to do, you know, an hour of professional development versus 5 hours professional mm-hmm. development. And as a person who is not currently employed by a school district, I'm still long-term subbing, still all those things, the cost of doing it is different. It's very different. Because when you're employed by a public school, all that cost is kind of absorbed as you get that professional development through your employment. As someone who needed to find those classes on my own, that got a little tricky. And also, happy to do it. It was just I had to do a lot more digging than I was expecting. Mm-hmm. I know that I was looking through some of the websites and trying to find, okay, where were some of the classes that were approved? And some of them were classes that were only approved for school districts and were thousands of dollars, which I understand. Others of them I had to dig through a little bit, and I'm like, okay, here's a $30 option. Okay. It's something that I think that as we have teachers who are wanting to, who when we want them to get back into the profession, it's something that maybe we need to think about as what are some of the offerings, especially those who are not currently employed into the school district. Thank you so much, Chair Bennett.
All right. Thank you. That's it, except I do have one more question, Dr. Bailey, if I could. And I'm just wondering if you could elaborate a little further on the specific licensure for ethnic studies. And I'm wondering, does that mean that a social studies teacher would not be able to teach a ethnic studies course?
Chair Bennett, sorry, I was trying to find my slide, but it's lost in there, so hopefully it's in your packets. So as Dr. Payne mentioned, we have a current rulemaking project that includes ethnic study licensure. So there's a couple of things that are happening. With the incorporation of ethnic studies academic standards, some of that is folded into social studies courses, and that can be taught by a social studies teacher. And then there are standalone courses that are ethnic studies courses, and those would be taught by someone with the training in ethnic studies. That rulemaking also includes an endorsement for social studies teachers because there's significant overlap in the standards, and so it would be a fairly easy add-on if they decide, I want to add this on to increase my own expertise and to teach these, you know, standalone courses. The other key thing I'll bring up, and I know, Chair, you've been a big proponent of this, is we are doing our work to support many pathways to licensure, not just the traditional ones. And so we have a lot of educators out there who have, in fact, been teaching ethnic studies as electives before there was any sort of standards or regulation. And so we had a lot of those educators come, along with some experts from higher ed and classroom teachers, to say, can we work with you on a way that honors our experience and our expertise so that we can get licensed, for example, through portfolio? And so we estimate that a good majority of those folks are going to use portfolio to take their current experience and their background and their training to get licensure that way so they can continue teaching the courses that they're currently teaching.
Thank you. And so just as an add-on, has there been discussion as you implement these peer ethnic studies courses, will some social studies teachers get grandfathered in? Is there going to be a grace period to allow them to get these additional educational needs? Or what's the plan for that?
Question, Chair Bennett, members. So there is always an effective date that's a bit further out. So if, for example, teacher prep decided to do programs, they need plenty of time to develop those programs. And as Aaron walked through the approval for that, but for portfolio, they could immediately start working on those things. I will say that all of this comes down largely to local control and how a district decides. Are they offering a social studies course that focuses on some of the standards incorporated, or are they choosing an ethnic studies course that they want someone to have that ethnic studies license? And that's going to be up to those districts to make that local decision.
Thank you. I think that concludes our member discussion here. So next item on the agenda, and thank you so much for the presentation and the answers. Next item on the agenda is the bill draft language from Representative Mueller. And as Representative Mueller gets settled at the table, just a reminder, this will be informational only since we don't have a formal bill. And Rep. Mueller will explain that this is a work in process. And I know we do have one testifier. I'm going to, I'll invite that testifier forward after Rep. Mueller presents. And with that, as soon as you're settled in, Representative Mueller, please identify yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Representative Patricia Mueller from 23B. And I'm really excited, Chair Bennett, to just start the conversation, especially as we were talking about what Representative Hill was mentioning about mentorship and teacher retention and how are we able to really prepare our teachers for the classroom. A couple years ago, a decision was made to remove the pedagogy test for our teachers that graduate from a Minnesota teacher prep school. And as much as I did not appreciate that decision, something that I was told was that teaching is a performative profession, something that that can simply not be captured on a paper pencil test. I happen to agree and think that this is a way for us to use something that we already currently have of student teaching and make it more robust and make it some sort of an independent measurement for our student, for our teacher candidates so that they can be ready for our, for the classroom. Still 100% a work in progress. We already have a tiered license system, so we have the ability to have a residency program. And what this would do, basically, it would be require that our student teaching, that our candidates would be required to complete a year-long student teaching residency program. And that this would be an ongoing mentorship, coaching and supervision. They'd be under a master teacher, and they would have structured learning experience in any type of professional development planning that needs to be there. A person must have a stipend or a salary, so they would be paid during this. The expectation is that they would be paid, and that any fringe benefits that would align would be applicable with any collective bargaining, and we can, again, all of those discussions are in the future and what that would look like. This clinical experience would be sustained classroom-focused professional development with intensive supervision and structural support. I don't know about Mr. Hill or some of our other teachers in the room, but I had a very, what I think, truncated experience where I was in the classroom for maybe 8 weeks, and that at that time, this is back in the early 2000s, don't want to date myself, but back at that time, that I was only required to be in charge of all the classes. I did an eighth grade English school that I was at, position, that I only had to be in charge of all the classes for 2 weeks. Other than that, I was just kind of whatever my mentor teacher allowed me to do. 2 weeks is not enough. It's just not enough for anyone to be able to understand fully what a whole school year is like, what a teacher needs to do, and all of those things. And so this just gives us an opportunity for our current student teaching to be a little bit more robust and an independent measurement of how we can see if our teacher candidates have completed competency and mastery of skills. This is work already being done in Louisiana. Louisiana completely has a mastery of competencies for their student teachers, where they actually have a list of competencies that they are looking to see the teacher candidate fulfill before they are able to get full complete practitioner license. So again, this is just kind of this idea of what we can look at that would give us a little bit more ability to have a fuller experience, but also ability to have more retention for our teachers as they are mentored by master teachers, and it can remove the barrier of working without any pay. So I have a lot more to say about this, but it's just beginning of the discussion, and I know my friend Ms. Caitlin Snyder would like to say a couple words.
Ms. Snyder, if you'd like to come up, and when you're settled in, go ahead and introduce yourself for the record and begin.
Hi, Madam Chair. Good afternoon, Representative Mueller. Caitlin Snyder with Education Minnesota. We represent 84,000 educators across the state. There's a lot of really good ideas put forward in this proposal. We have a 30-page document that guides all of our legislative positions, and our top priority in preparation and recruitment and retention is saying that we need paid student teaching, registered apprenticeships, as you have been working on as well, or residencies. Like, we need to remove this barrier to entry for teachers across the state. I also appreciate how this bill sets time for mentorship. The percentage of 80% teaching, so as they'd have time to actually meet with their mentor, how the mentor is called out and compensated in this proposal, I think those are really good bones. And we appreciate how much time there is for the mentorship and induction of probationary teachers. One of the pieces we don't love as much is the divide that we have between our traditionally trained teachers and our non-traditionally trained teachers. So I studied Spanish at the University of Minnesota. I could go teach Spanish as a tier one teacher for the rest of my life if I wanted to. I could teach as a tier two if I enrolled in college. The way I read this bill, it would add another year to teacher prep for our traditionally trained teachers. We continue to raise expectations, both in relicensure, not necessarily in a bad way when we're talking about mental health and other areas, for our traditionally trained teachers, but it's not necessarily applying to all of our teachers. So how do we square that conversation?
Thank you. Representative Mueller, do you have any comments before we go on to member questions?
Yeah, and thank you so much, Madam Chair, and I just really appreciate looking at things. I'll tell you, I sat with Nonpartisan a week and a half ago and said, this is my idea, what can we put together for us to start this conversation? Very, very skeleton language. And so there's going to obviously be plenty of facets of this that we're going to have to iron out, but I think what's really important is that currently right now, I believe that our current traditional pathway is being, it could be a little bit more robust as we think about how we can have better retention for our teachers. This doesn't have to be, and again, there's lots of states that have year-round residencies, and some of them are used to grab more people from other places. This is simply saying, for someone who goes through traditional pathways, I mean, maybe as things have changed, but I spent 40 hours in a classroom and then had those 2 weeks for my student teaching. It's just not enough. And I was one of the few that, I've been a teacher now for over 20 years. I didn't leave after 5 years. I've been there for a long time and was still teaching last semester. So I'm still active in the classroom and I love doing it. But I just think something like this is going to not only provide a little bit more coalition of what it can look like. Some people have done this where, hey, if we have a host school, that they're able to have a job afterwards. You know, if you decide that you're going to go do your student teaching in more of a rural area or even an urban area, that there's a job. There's a possibility of those type of connections, but. Yeah, I just think that we have, this is a good start of us to have this conversation, and I look forward to being able to work through that with Edmund. So.
Thank you, Representative Mueller and Ms. Snyder. And members, do we have any questions? It sounds like a good work in progress. Yes. Representative Bierman.
Thank you, Chair Bennett. You mentioned, sorry, I just had to step out, but I just wanted to check at the end there, you said a lot of states have programs like this. Could you be more?
Sure. Sorry,
Chair. Representative Mueller.
Thank you, Chair Bennett, and thank you, Representative Bierman. And I think when I said a lot of states, what I mean is that there's lots of states that are having lots of different pathways. We are seeing registered teacher apprenticeships in over 40 states right now. We are seeing people trying to do alternative licensure in multiple areas. Indiana is doing that. North Dakota is doing that. There's lots of different areas that people are doing that. This idea of replacing what current student teaching is looking like, I've only seen it in, I've actually only when I when I did my research at 1 a.m. this morning because I couldn't sleep, that sounds familiar. when I was looking at that, I saw North Carolina had something that would allow student teaching to be a little bit more robust, a residency. That student teaching program at that time would be the first semester would be only 20% in the classroom and 80% or 20% in the residency classroom, 80% still finishing their college experience, and then the last half of that would be almost 100%. So to me, that's kind of a wash where you're not a whole school year in the classroom. The only other time I've ever really seen this is when I looked at Louisiana and their competency. I didn't necessarily see that they has a residency program, but that they had moved to looking at competency-based student teaching rather than just, hey, you completed this clinical experience, the end. And so I think that is a good alternative for us as we have removed the paper pencil teaching test. And again, those are things that I understood what was happening. I just think that we still need an independent measurement for our student teachers to make sure that they're competent and highly qualified.
Representative Bierman, any follow-up? No? All right. Thank you. And that looks like, Chair Jordan. Representative Keeler, then Chair Jordan, I'll let you end that here. Go ahead, Representative Keeler.
Thanks, Chair. I have a bunch of questions, and we can meet offline because I know that this is, like, in the works. But so a couple places it just says, like, includes a year-long student teaching or full school year, I guess, because this is more in higher ed, right? Like when people, and we've done a lot of work to try to get over that one weird semester that's like you're a student at a higher ed institution, but you're not earning the credits, you're not able to get scholarships because you're not identified as a full-time student. You know, we've talked a lot about this. So if a student right now would be doing their semester of student teaching in the spring to graduate in May. Tell me what you mean when you mean a full time, because what I'm nervous about is that if it has to be a full school year and the way that people are set up in college and they're doing different things, now we're making them wait until fall to have a year. And so I just need you to kind of walk through that, because what we don't want to do is extend more time in higher ed. I agree both the host teachers should be paid and checked on, because a lot of times they will just pawn things off onto their student teachers, and we don't want a year of pawning off, right? We want it to be, and so I do think paying and checking in, but more than just the teacher candidate compensation, I think to ask them to be in an education setting for 1 year, we also need to address benefits and what that potentially looks like, because we're taking on now what could look like five, maybe even 5.5, 6 years of a higher education lane. And so if you just want to answer high level there, and then maybe we can lean into it a little bit more, but those would be the big things that I get worried about. I hear what you're trying to do. I appreciate what you're trying to do. I just do not want to prolong the higher ed experience, because I don't think we can cut short, you know, any practicum or early education work in the higher ed path.
good questions. And Representative Mueller, we're going to give this probably another 5 minutes, and then I want Pelsby to get a chance to have their bills heard. And excellent questions, but I'll let you go ahead and respond to that, and then we'll have Chair Jordan.
Thank you, Chair Bennett, and thank you, Representative Keeler. Pelsby in the bill currently as it stands would still have to do some rulemaking and to be able to talk about what that relationship between you know, student teacher, mentor teacher, what that would actually look like, so that it's not just hey, look, you're like my little assistant and go ahead and do that. Like, this is a specific, if my goal of making this be a performative thing so that it actually is a good replacement for, in what my opinion of the pedagogy test, this would be more than just, hey, I'm your assistant for a year. That doesn't make any sense. For your initial question of, we don't want to prolong this, I could see us, because I was one who actually had to go an extra semester. I wasn't ready to graduate in the spring, and so I started, you know, and I graduated in the winter. So it is kind of that weird thing, and school is weird that it doesn't follow a calendar year, so that's awkward. But I could see us doing some exceptions for this, as if it was a year-round experience that, but they still needed to finish up a couple of classes, we could still make that be a, you know, 60-40 type of thing where they can still finish up those classes and but still expected to be part-time at the school and then move into full-time at the school. I'm open to those discussions because of the fact that things get a little strange that way. My goal is to make sure that we have a full school year of mentorship so that we can see that these teacher candidates are ready for the school. And honestly, this is why registered teacher apprenticeship was so difficult, because teaching isn't plumbing. And it's not the same as doing something as simple as, you know, go and do this. Teaching is much more complex than that. And so it deserves a lot of discussion. And this is just the start of that. So thank you, Representative Keeler.
Thank you. And Representative Keeler, are you okay with taking the rest of your questions offline? I think they're really good, and since this is a work in progress, it's very good. So thank you for those. Chair Jordan.
Thank you, Chair Bennett. And before I thank Vice Chair Muir, I want to thank you for having this conversation, because kudos to you, Vice Chair Muir. I think this is a really good idea, and I'm not going to ask any questions. I'm just going to throw some things out here that I hope you'll consider. One is kind of that subdivision 3 for teacher candidate on 5.4. Mm-hmm. I think that's going to need a lot of examination from some lawyer types, and probably like Bureau of Mediation, just because I've done some of that work with all of that, and there are going to be a lot of CBA interactions. I think it would be interesting to talk about how, what the difference is between a stipend and what the difference is between a salary. You know, those can be very different things, and they can be quite significant, and how that is going to interact with existing collective bargaining agreements that can occur based off of the steps and lanes. That is just one where I see, as a former union organizer, that's just one where I see there being a lot of potential for negotiation snarls, which we all want to avoid. But I think this is a really great idea, and you know, we do hear, I do think we're, like, in talking about that retention conversation we just had, I think making sure that our some of the people who we want to be, I'm also want to know how this is going to interact with things like grow your own programs, which has been one of the number one ways we've gotten more people with who, like, in some ways have actually already undergone some of this work, but how this will interact with grow your own programs to get people like our ESPs on a full-time teaching license. That's something that I think we all agree has been an amazing program, and we want to see more teacher candidates like that who probably don't have a year to take off of their life if the stipend is going to be something that is less than their current salary, as in paraprofessional, for example. And so those are some things I would like us to work on going forward, is some of those issues around, you know, teaching is an art. I agree with that. It's a calling. It's obvious talking to Dr. Hill and yourself and Chair Bennett and all the other educators that we know that this is truly a calling and an art. But it's also a job. And making sure that it's a, and that has been one of the things when I talk to teachers who have left the classroom, they just found better jobs, period, where they made more money, they had less stress. And so thinking through this and how we can make this both that calling and art, but also that job is really important. So I hope we can think through some of those things as this moves forward. But thank you for all your work on this.
Thank you. Representative Mueller, any final comments?
Yeah, thank you, Chair Bennett. And, you know, I kind of got some of this idea from the fact that, you know, just as much of an artwork and everything is as our physicians, who when they have to, you know, learn how to become a physician, they are not just going to school, taking a pencil paper test, but now they often have year-long residencies where they're doing and multiple, right? It's depending on what specialties they're going into. And so as we are professionalizing the business, because that's what this is, we often as teachers feel very very secondary because of the things that happen. I want to honor that. I want to honor the fact that we are professionals and we can we should be able to offer a professional residency. I see Grow Your Own very differently in the sense that we already have people who have experiences and be able to bring them along, and maybe we can talk about what could be exceptions for a year-long residency. But for a person who is going from a traditional pathway to the classroom, making sure that they have an ample opportunity to experience the ebbs and flows of that and to be mentored by a master teacher, I think requires more than 2 to 8 weeks. So I look forward to the conversation, and thank you so much, Chair Bennett, for giving me the opportunity to talk about it.
Good to hear this. It's a monumental task, but a worthy one. So thank you for that. And I think Minnesota could be a pioneer in this. We don't always have to follow some other state, right? We can be the pioneers. So here we go. Next on the agenda will be House File 3635 and House File 3638. So I'll invite Pels to be back to the table. And then as soon as they're ready here, I'm going to represent Vice Chair Hill to move and present each bill in order. So again, to the testifiers, when you're ready, if you would state your name for the record and proceed with your presentation. And Representative Hill, let's see. I'm sorry. We're going to let Pelsby start. I'm sorry. Go ahead. So whoever would like to start first, go ahead and introduce yourself.
Thank you, Chair Bennett. I'd like to move House File 3635 before the committee to be laid over. And I do want to introduce once again Dr. Yelena Bailey, who is going to walk through the provisions of the bill.
Thank you. So Representative Hill moves House File 3635 before the committee with the chair's intention to lay it over for further consideration at a later date. So Representative Hill and partners there, if you would present your bill.
Slight technical difficulties, Chair Bennett and members, but I think that
okay,
here we go.
Take your time, because we had paper difficulties earlier.
We're finally here. So I will do a brief walkthrough of the Interstate Teacher Mobility Compact. I believe that's first up. This shows you a map of where legislation has been introduced or passed across the country. So this is still something that's in movement. I see looks of confusion. Hopefully I'm on the right track. Chair Bennett.
Yeah. All right. I'm just distracted today. Dr. Bailey, did you have?
Yeah. Okay, perfect.
We're all set?
Yep. So this compact is much like other occupational compacts in that it would allow some flexibility for teachers to move amongst the member states. It does have a few things that make it distinct, and so I'll just highlight those here. Instead of someone using their out-of-state license to teach in Minnesota, for example, a teacher would be issued a license in the member state. And so that retains a lot of Minnesota's sovereignty and authority over licenses and data, which I'll mention as I do a very, very brief walkthrough of this language. A couple of key pieces here is to be eligible for the compact, a license has to have three qualities. It has to require a bachelor's degree, with the exception of career and technical education. It has to require completion of state-approved teacher preparation. And then it must be unencumbered, meaning it can't be limited or restricted in terms of renewal or term. So, yes? Perfect. Thank you. Article 1 of this simply defines the purpose of the compact to increase teacher mobility across states. Article 2 just outlines some of the key terms and definitions for participation in the compact. And then Article 3 describes the model of reciprocity between member states that join the compact. One thing I should say as I'm moving through this is language that was developed originally from the Department of Defense to support military spouses, then taken on by the Council of State Governors, and it has to be adopted in whole without changes by each member state in order to be effective. If there are any changes, it is null and void. So you'll notice in that map, some states where it's kind of grayed out because they introduced the legislation or passed it with changes, and so they're not actually eligible to be a part of the compact. Article 4 simply highlights a few cases where states maintain their authority. So, for example, this has zero change on our ability to have renewal requirements, additional requirements on renewal for a teacher who comes in through the compact and gets licensed in Minnesota. We can require additional documentation for the purposes of salary schedule. That's common in other states, not so much here. The state maintains ownership over the licensing data, and then any existing reciprocity agreements maintain their authority. Article 5 simply outlines the requirements to use those, and I mentioned those before, what makes a license eligible for the compact. So they have to, in addition to meeting those three criteria, they have to undergo a state background check in whichever state they're getting their license in. And then if that state requires additional information for the sake of compensation, they must provide that as well. Article 6 simply states that member states retain authority over discipline, so it has zero impact on our ability to conduct our ethics investigations. Article 7 just outlines the authority of the commission, and that's a governing body that helps facilitate this compact across the member states. Article 8 outlines rulemaking authority of the compact, and again, if a state decides that they want to vote to modify that authority or those rules, that can happen at the state legislature level. So there's lots of built-in guarantees of state sovereignty. Article 9 requires that the commission helps facilitate this across the states. Article 10 has some things that ensure compliance with the compact and procedures if a member state fails to be in compliance with the rules of the compact. Article 11 simply outlines the enactment date and terms for withdrawal or amendment. Article 12 outlines the relationship of this compact with state constitutions and the federal constitution. And then Article 13 just reiterates that teachers are still subject to the member state's scope and jurisdiction of practice. And that is my very, very quick walkthrough of that bill. Happy to answer member questions.
You did a good job with that, Dr. Bailey. And what I'm going to have you do, and I'm sorry to be confusing or if it makes it more difficult, but I'm going to have you continue your presentation. So we'll get that done just for time's sake. Then we'll discuss each bill. You know, we'll start with 36, 35, but go ahead and continue your presentation, if you would, on the other bill as well, and then we'll, pardon?
Thank you,
Dr. Excuse me, wait 1 second here. Excuse me, as a chair.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a procedural question. This bill is currently on the table before us. Do we need to lay it over and pick up the other bill, or she's just going to speak? We're all good?
Yeah.
Okay,
great. We'll have the, excuse me, thank you. We'll have the presentation. But then we will go back to the original bill that's already on the table here, whatever the proper wording is for that, and go on. But go ahead and finish giving us information, and then we'll go from there. Thank you. And good question, Chair Jordan.
Okay, great. Happy to speak to our agency bill, Chair Bennett, members. So this is a pretty simple bill in terms of operations, and then there are a few pieces that I know Representative Mueller kind of signaled to around the renewal requirement, and then something that helps with out-of-state reciprocity. So sections 1 through 3 are operational. This would move the voluntary paraprofessional credential to MTE. We continue to carry this in our agency bill simply because we do not have staff or expertise on anything related to non-licensed staff. So, as I mentioned, we're a staff of 26 when fully staffed compared to our larger sibling over at MDE. So, in alignment with their jurisdiction and capacity, it makes more sense for this to sit with them. Section 4 would allow us to enter into a data sharing agreement with BOSA, the Board of School Administrators. We currently have a data sharing agreement with MDE, and sometimes for the sake of checking compliance or being able to license their school administrators, they need access to data on assignments, but because it's private until we publish it. They can't get that data, which of course delays things for our school administrators. So this is simple, allowing us to enter into a data sharing agreement with them. Section 5 would allow Pelsby to add forfeiture fees to our operations budget. And I believe, I don't know if the language carried over here from the Senate, but this would be used for our IT needs. So the government relations from Minute was here, but had to unfortunately leave, but would speak to the fact that ongoing maintenance for our system, once it's finally built, will be more significant than they anticipated. So in an effort to not have to ask you all for more money, this is one way that we could address that need. We get forfeiture fees each year because, unfortunately, there are a significant number of, or a few hundred, I should say, applicants who don't complete their applications. So when someone starts an application, they're notified, these are non-refundable fees. They have 60 days to complete their application. We reach out, encourage folks to complete those applications, but last fiscal year, we had about 800 individuals who just didn't complete them. And so the licensing fee portion goes back to the general fund, but the background fee, which is about that $30, sits in a special expense account. And so we are requesting to be able to use that towards IT. And it's not a significant amount. I should say that was about $26,000 last fiscal year. So the next section is about addressing the mental health training for our teachers. As we know, there's increasing needs, both our students and our teachers, around mental health. One of the changes is just technical for Section 6 and 8 to replace mental illness with a more holistic term, mental health. And then Section 9, as Representative Mueller spoke to before, really clarifies some of that language for the existing requirement and then would prompt us to do rulemaking to really flesh out, again, what should be included in those existing trainings. Section 7 is about removing barriers to licensure, and so this would change the eligibility for Tier 2 to include teachers who are in an out-of-state program with aligned requirements in student teaching. And this for us is a bit of an equity piece. So once someone completes a program that's out of state, as long as there's equivalent student teaching, they get a license here immediately as long as they've met the testing requirements. So it seems that it would be only reasonable to do the same thing if they are enrolled in a program for a Tier 2. We see this often, for example, in Moorhead, where someone might want to work in Moorhead schools but is enrolled in a program across the border in Fargo but can't get that Tier 2 license right now. We don't anticipate this being a large number of individuals, but we have heard anecdotally from districts and partners that this would help meet some of those shortage needs. We think it would be particularly useful in some areas where we don't have licensure programs in Minnesota. So blind and visually impaired, for example, we don't have any licensure programs. Someone who wants to enroll out of state and practice in Minnesota would help fill those needs. Section 10 is simply a time extension. We promise we're not requesting additional funds. A few years ago, you all at the legislature granted us the funds needed to get off of paper applications, knock on wood one day, and be able to have an online licensing system that helps expedite licensing for all of our teachers. We've been working with Minute on this, and we're able to come to the conclusion we need a third-party vendor for this work, and so they need an extension to be able to get the RFP going and get that work done. So this provides an extra 2 years for them to use those funds and get that system built out. And that concludes the hopefully also very brief walkthrough of that bill.
Very good. Thank you. So the idea here is to have the presentation and then we'll have Representative Hill. Now you've already moved your bill, House File 3635. So I'm going to have you introduce your actual bill now, Representative Hill. And this is the one on the teacher compact. So if you have anything to add, I guess that'd be my question. No, or do you want to leave it at this?
Thank you, Chair Bennett. I move the adoption or laying over House File 3635.
All right, thank you. So I do know we have two testifiers for 3635, Valerie Doslin and Patrick Baker, if you could come forward. And then once there, you can identify yourself for the record. And please keep your comments to about 2 minutes. So Ms. Doslin, we'll start with you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Valerie Doslin. I am here on behalf of the Minnesota Association of School Administrators, the Minnesota Administrators for Special Education, and then my colleagues with the School Boards Association and the Association of Metropolitan School Districts also wanted me to let the committee know they support both the bills before you today. In regards to the Teacher Mobility Compact, Minnesota schools, you've heard about the struggle that they have with teacher shortages, and it is becoming increasingly difficult to fill critical classroom positions, especially in the areas of special education. While our school administrators are committed to ensuring that every student has a qualified licensed teacher in front of them, too often districts are often forced to rely on long-term substitutes, out-of-field permissions, or leave positions unfilled because there simply are not enough licensed educators available. These shortages directly affect students' access to consistent support, individualized services, and the stable relationships they need to succeed. So the Interstate Compact, I just want to point out three things. One, it eliminates barriers for teachers with valid licenses from other compact states to receive a Minnesota license more quickly. It supports our district's ability to recruit talent and fill positions, and it maintains high standards for teachers as they must still hold meaningful licensure and meet professional requirements. So I just encourage you to support that proposal. In regards to House File 3638, I just wanted to highlight our support for the provision that would allow more flexibility for a Tier 2 teacher to be enrolled in a teacher prep program, whether it's here in Minnesota or out of state. This proposal expands options for Tier 2 teachers to enroll in programs that best fit their location, schedule, and professional needs, even if those programs are based out of state. And the Executive Director Bailey mentioned this isn't affect too many teachers, but we do hear from superintendents about this needed flexibility. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Baker, introduce yourself for the record if you would and begin.
Thank you, Chair Bennett, Chair Jordan. My name is Patrick Baker. I have the pleasure of leading government relations for the School of Education at Western Governors University. In addition to my day job, I also serve as a elected school board member in Mankato Area Public Schools, and so really excited to be here in my home state testifying on behalf of WGU. Similar to my colleague, Ms. Dulson, I'll just talk about both bills because we are supportive of both. But before I dive in to that, just a brief word on WGU. As you may not know who we are, but Western Governors University was founded about 30 years ago now by 19 Western Governors to be a nonprofit, affordable, online university with a specific mission, and that is to create pathways to opportunity for working adult learners. One of the key differentiators for WGU is that our programs are entirely competency-based. So we hold learning constant and time variable. WGU now enrolls more than 200,000 students seeking degrees and certificates in healthcare, business, IT, and teaching, and we have more than 425,000 graduates now across the country. But it is teaching that brings me to you today, and WGU operates the largest teachers college in the country with 45,000 students currently enrolled. Last year alone, our School of Education graduated nearly 20,000 individuals across the country, including 270 right here in Minnesota. We are proud to be the only teacher college in the country that actually licenses in all 50 states, and that we are accredited by both of the major national accreditors for programs of education, CAPE and AQIP. Our footprint in Minnesota is significant and unique. We currently have about 300 Minnesotans enrolled in programs leading to initial teacher licensure at WGU, but these are not your typical college students. They're working adults who reflect the modern teacher workforce. 70% of our students in teacher licensure are over 25, 80% are working well enrolled at WGU, and 85% transferred in prior college credit. Most importantly for this committee, WGU is a vital pipeline for greater Minnesota. 46% of our initial licensure students reside in rural areas in Minnesota, and we have students living in 69 of Minnesota's 87 counties. With respect to Tier 2 and the agency bill, strongly support the bill that would create that eligibility for students enrolled in out-of-state approved programs to be eligible for Tier 2 licenses. So currently, despite our students being eligible to apply directly to Pelsby to a Tier 3 license upon their graduation, as Director Bailey indicated, they are barred from accessing a Tier 2 license while they train to be a teacher. And so this exclusion creates an equitable barrier for Minnesotans who are in need of these pathways the most. Specifically, we have 80 students in Minnesota who entered WGU with a non-teaching bachelor's degree. And because they cannot access a Tier 2 license, their pathway to the classroom is less accessible than their peers at in-state institutions. So for us, this is creating real-world problems for some partnerships we're working to do here in Minnesota. with respect to SPED pipeline grants that are run out of MDE, WGU is actively a eligible and actively participating partner, a higher ed institution in that. So we have run into issues where our SPED pipeline candidates who are receiving state dollars to get trained as a teacher are unable to access these programs, and that's becoming more and more problematic for us. In addition, we are in advanced talks right now with Teach for America Twin Cities to do a partnership with some of their teacher cadets. And again, these are all folks with bachelor's degrees who would want to enroll in a teacher prep program to stay teachers and become teachers. And that tier two barrier is a barrier for our students to participate in that Teach for America partnership. So today we need more teachers than ever, both Minnesota-based approved programs and out of state can play a really unique role in supporting the state's teacher pathways. And I would just say, you know, in respect to the Teacher Mobility Compact, very supportive of the bill. As an institution that operates nationwide, licenses in all 50 states, we see firsthand how licensure barriers prevent qualified teachers from filling vacancies where they are needed most. And so the compact can preserve Minnesota's high standards for teacher prep while ensuring that qualified teacher candidates in one state can seamlessly become a qualified teacher here in Minnesota. So thanks for the opportunity to be before you today, and happy to answer any questions if you have those. But
thank you, and thanks for the testifiers who kind of doing your homework right while you're up there. We can save some time from the up and down, and Mr. Shaver, when the next bill comes up, we'll get you up here too. So members, thank you to the testifiers, and I don't have any testifiers, I don't think, left here for this particular bill, which we're just going to talk about, the Teacher Compact bill right now. So I do want to direct your attention, members, to some of the materials provided in your folders regarding the proposed compact. Do we have any member questions on just this portion, 3635, the Teacher Compact proposal here? We've got Representative Lawrence.
Madam Chair, thank you very much. Representative Hill, quick question. I have a testifier to answer this question or not, but as we look at joining this compact, the possibility of being a part of a compact like this, for us as a state, would there be any additional requirements of an educator? Would there be any additional classes, any additional hours that they may have to take if we were able to join us?
Representative Hill.
Thank you, Chair Bennett. And just speaking from my own experience, the answer is no. My own experience, my wife's career took us shortly after I started my teaching career to Pennsylvania, suburban Philadelphia. And the amount of gymnastics I had to engage in to get a Pennsylvania license to teach during those 10 weeks of summer was quite a bit. And so what we're seeking to do here is to remove barriers that would allow educators to enter into our state and serve our students here.
Representative Lawrence, any follow-up? Okay.
Thank you.
Representative Green.
Thank you so much, Chair Bennett. And thank you so much, Rep. Hill, for bringing this bill forward. I think it's great. I think it's a really creative way to just lower the barriers, as you said. I was just curious about any kind of data or research that's been done on how many teachers move around from state to state and what that looks like.
Dr. Bailey, it looks like you're going to take that one. Would you like to?
Chair Bennett, members, we don't have that in front of me, but there is, the Compact has its own website with some resources, and I believe they do have some of the data on there, as well as the Council of State Governors has some data on that as well. So happy to chat offline and see if I can find some of that for you.
Good to go. Chair Jordan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I have two questions. My first one is for Dr. Bailey. It's great that there are not additional barriers for Minnesota for people who want to become a Minnesota educator, but are we missing anything by joining this compact? Like, kind of the opposite question, are we missing anything in licensure if someone is, you know, we have different licensure standards in other states? I'll pick on my sister-in-law who teaches in Nebraska. If she comes and teaches in Minnesota, is there something that by having her Nebraska teaching license she's missing out on if she were to become a Minnesota educator that is important to us?
Dr. Bailey?
Chair Bennett, members, great question. So for all practical purposes, because of the work you all have done over the last few years to streamline out of state, this mostly would just reduce kind of the paperwork barriers so that you can, instead of having to ask for transcripts and all of that information, they could just do the background check and immediately get their license. But because it has the same bar for all of the eligible licenses, we're not having any concerns about kind of high quality moving either out or into Minnesota.
Great. And then I had a, thank you, Madam Chair. And then I had a question for Mr. Baker.
Mr. Baker, go ahead and come on back up. And go ahead, Chair Jordan.
Yep. Thank you for coming back, Mr. Baker. And please let me know if there's a better title for you. But I had a question about, I'm looking at your written testimony and what you said about Teach for America and how you're partnering with Teach for America. Can you talk to me a little bit more about that and how entering this compact is essential to that? And then will this lead to an increase in Teach for America candidates teaching in Minnesota schools?
Mr. Baker.
So a couple things there. We, WGU, just entered a national partnership with Teach for America where we are now going district by district, region by region, and working with TFA sort of regions across the country. And the idea there, right, is these TFA candidates are coming in with a bachelor's degree. They're teaching on some sort of, usually it's a temporary license as they are going through that process. And those that choose to become teachers and stick around oftentimes need to go back to a teacher prep program to get that full teacher prep license. And so what we are doing is providing an opportunity for them to go to a fully online competency-based university so that they can work their Teach for America job full-time, get their degree, and come out at the end with a fully blown license in that state that allows them to continue on beyond the sort of Teach for America initial core experience. So in Minnesota, with our inability to access Tier 2, that provides more of a challenge for our students because once they enroll at WGU, if they're in a TFA experience here, they've got to try and get a Tier 1 license. And obviously we know there are more barriers with that, and there's time limits and things like that. And so with the Tier 2 piece, those TFA candidates in particular, but not just TFA, anyone that's got a bachelor's degree that's trying to come back to school would be able to access those pathways to Tier 3 a bit more easy. Hope that answers the question.
Thank you, Mr. Baker. And Chair Jordan says she's good to go, so thank you. Good questions. Representative Hill, any closing comments?
No, the Interstate Compact is before you to be laid over, and I fully support it.
Thank you, Representative Hill. And with that, the Chair lays over House File 3635 for future consideration at a later date. And now Representative Hill moves House File 3638 before the committee, with the chair's intention to lay this over for further consideration at a later date. Representative Hill, please present your bill.
Well, wonderful. Once again, we're trying to remove barriers, and once again, I have an experience set as someone who went to school at UW River Falls across the border over in Wisconsin. Yet I student taught here in Minnesota, in St. Paul Public Schools, and also in 622 over in Oakdale at Tartan High School. And so this will help to remove some of the barriers for getting teachers in front of our Minnesota students.
Thank you, Representative Hill. And members, we have one testifier. We had the other two already. So Mr. Shaver, would you like to come up?
Sure.
And as soon as you're ready, go ahead and introduce yourself for the record and begin.
Chair Bennett, members of the committee, good afternoon. My name is Matt Shaver. I am a teacher, and I'm the Senior Policy Director at Allies. We're an education advocacy organization that supports policies that strengthen and diversify our teacher workforce. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today on the Pelsby Agency Bill, HF 3638. Thank you to Representative Hill for carrying it. I'm here to highlight our organizational support for the proposal on page 6, lines 4 and 5, to add a pathway back to qualify for Tier 2 license. As has been mentioned already, this would allow enrollment in out-of-state teacher preparation programs as a way to move from Tier 1 to Tier 2 or to qualify for Tier 2, which would allow effective classroom teachers a way to continue their needed and worthwhile work in the classroom. And briefly, while I'm here, I want to highlight and praise some new findings in Pelsby's 2025 Supply and Demand Report. If you've listened to Allies even a little on this committee over the last few years, you've heard discussions around more accurately measuring the teacher shortage by incorporating data on unfilled positions, similar to states like Illinois. There have been bipartisan bill efforts led by others to have Pell's be collect vacancy data that ultimately haven't made it across the legislative finish line. On pages 8, 39, 48, 50, and 64 of the 2025 Supply and Demand Report, you'll see evidence of Pell's be incorporating unfilled position data into its definition of demand, asking districts to report on that data and sharing meaningful statistics on the number of unfilled teaching positions, showing, for example, that last year, 25 districts in Minnesota reported having unfilled or canceled math courses, robbing students of opportunities to be college and career ready. Imagine that, a state agency not needing a law to be passed by the legislature to do the right thing, taking that feedback and going above and beyond what's required by statute to seek out more useful data. So tons of kudos and credit to Pell's Bee for their work on that. Hopefully more to come. So finally, one last area of new data to highlight in the supply and demand report was Pell's Bee asking districts which internal recruitment programs they have used and which they found to be most effective. 418 of 560 Minnesota districts responded, a remarkably high response rate for a survey. Pages 44 and 45 of the supply and demand report show that the Tier 2 to Tier 3 experience pathway is the program most used and rated as most effective by schools. It's also the one program on the list that the state of Minnesota has needed to invest $0 into. And unfortunately, the most effective internal recruitment program has become less effective over time because of changes made to who can be a Tier 2 teacher. There's temporary eligibility for renewal for Tier 2 licenses that is coming to an end at the end of the school year. So while we support the proposal in HF 3638 to build a new pathway to Tier 2 without enrollment and out-of-state teacher prep, the state should expand additional pathways to Tier 2. It would continue to cost the state $0 to make the most effective pathway usable again for more working educators. I want to thank you all for the opportunity to testify today. Thank you for this bill, and thank you all for your public service to our state.
Thank you, and thank you again to all of our testifiers. And members, do we have any questions on this particular bill, the agency bill? And Representative Hill, did you want to make a comment?
Yeah, Chair Bennett, apologies. We have a very minor amendment on that same line referenced by Mr. Shaver, page 6, line 4. The previous language states here is enrolled in a Minnesota-approved teacher preparation program. The language that is more congruent with other statutes is a state-approved teacher preparation program. And so if nonpartisan can speak to that.
Ms. Pera.
Chair Bennett and members, yes. So the amendment would read page 6, line 4, delete Minnesota-approved and insert state-approved. And we can make a note of that.
Thank you. Okay, so we can address that at a future time, it sounds like. Okay, thank you. Chair Jordan, would you like to?
Thank you, Madam Chair. It also looks like it says Minnesota approved in the line 6.3. If we're cleaning up the statute, should we clean up that line as well? Or is there a difference between Minnesota versus state approved in those two lines?
Ms. Pera?
Chair Bennett, Chair Jordan, yes. The difference would be that this changing Minnesota approved to state approved is what would allow the out-of-state candidates to qualify for the license.
All right, good. So this is, we'll work on that amendment. That will be coming, correct? We're not adding that on now. So we'll work on that and get that language right. Okay, that sounds good. So now we have Representative Lawrence who has a question.
Madam Chair, thank you so much. Representative Hill, thank you for the bill before us. You had made a comment at the introduction of some barriers. And I'm just curious, what were your, what are the barriers that you're referencing, personal barriers that you saw that you hoping to eliminate with this bill in particular?
Representative Hill.
Thank you, Chair Bennett, and thank you for the question, Representative Lawrence. Some of the barriers had to do with some coursework. So, for example, I shared the experience of moving out to Philly and, you know, taking a look at their requirements. And one of their requirements was a course on Pennsylvania history. And so those are the different kinds of regulations that different states sometimes put in place. And I don't know if Dr. Bailey has other examples that are similar or matching to that, but that was my experience of a barrier that I had to quickly come to terms with. And I learned a lot about Pennsylvania really fast.
Dr. Bailey, did you have any additional comments? No? Okay, Representative Lawrence.
Yeah, Madam Chair, thank you. A few years ago, I found the love of my life, many years ago, but from California, and had a master's degree and would have made an excellent teacher. And, of course, I told her I didn't want to go to California, so she came here. But would have made an excellent teacher and looked into going into education here in Minnesota. With a master's degree, there was a year's worth of additional coursework for her to take. And at that point in time, after 6 years of being in higher education, she decided not to. And so I appreciate the effort of the bills that we're seeing today. Hopefully they're going in the same direction, but to reduce those barriers, because we need educators in and open the doors for them to get into education just a little bit easier. Thank you.
Yeah. Chair Jordan, do you have any final comments or questions before we go to Rep Hill?
You know, I will just say, Madam Chair, that I am very grateful to Vice Chair Hill for being our Pelsby guy on the DFL side here. It's a lot of work and it's a lot of technicality, and your experience and dedication to this definitely makes my life easier, but it also makes the lives of all Minnesotans better. So thank you for that work.
Vice Chair Hill, do you have any closing comments?
Thank you, Chair Bennett. Just a special shout out to previous Chair Pryor for quote unquote making me the Pelsby guy. So here we are today.
All right. Well, thank you. Well, with that, the Chair lays over House File 3638 for future consideration at a later date. Members, that concludes today's agenda. Our next meeting will be Wednesday, March 4th, 2026. And with that, the committee stands adjourned.